From Glitch HQ on Riverside Avenue in Lexicographel, long delayed Minneapolis, this is Nice Games Club, the show where Nice Game Devs talk gaming and game development.
I'm Martha McGarry, and I make nice games.
I'm Stephen McGregor, and I make nice games.
And I'm Arthur Croy, I too make nice games.
For this week's episode, our topics are writing for games and copyright in the public domain. And so, if everyone is ready,
let's start.
So we're back from PodCon 2.
Yeah.
Yes.
In Seattle.
Still tired, it seems.
Yeah, it happened.
Well, we had the PodCon where we were traveling, and then Global Game Jam where
that
you had to work
happened.
All weekend. So this is the first weekend. But now we're doing Nice Games Club and Widget Satchel in one weekend too. So
yep.
Nonstop.
A lot of things. A lot of stuff.
Yeah. And we actually pushed back the recording of this. This is all inside baseball, but like this episode's coming out real soon
yes. From
our calendar.
Yes.
So we should be really timely.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
It's like a rare opportunity to talk about things happening right now.
Yes. So what things happened this week? Man,
I have no idea.
Nothing happened. Record-breaking cold.
We almost froze to death, yeah. Every one of us.
Right. But I mean, other than that, we're fine.
My car stopped working. My bike got a flat tire.
Oh.
My coat broke.
Oh, my goodness.
So it was a disaster for transportation for me this week.
Dang, that sucks.
Yeah.
I got to work from home all week, and so I didn't have to go outside.
Some people get all grown up. Some of us got to wait for the train. It was not warm.
I'm sorry.
It's okay.
Well, our furnace almost went out.
Ah! So. Oh, jeez.
Mm-hmm. And here at Glitch,
furnaces going on.
Well, when we record, we have to turn the air conditioner or the heater off, mm-hmm. because it makes noise and we don't want any extra noise.
Right.
And it's a little tough right now.
Yep. Yeah. It's too. I got my jacket on, so that's going to have to help.
Uh-huh.
But it's real cold.
Well, anyway, PodCon 2.
Yes, PodCon 2 happened.
It was awesome.
Mm-hmm, it was a fun time.
Seattle is very cool. I can see why it's so expensive to live there, because it is super nice, like way nicer than San Francisco.
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah, and it rained when we were there.
Yes.
So it was the
very on brand.
Yeah, exactly. It was really fun.
Yeah, we went to see the Space Needle, and we also went to see the Living Computer Museum.
Oh my gosh!
Yeah, that was real fun.
Yeah.
It's so cool. They had all these old mainframes and old computers, and they were excited that we were there because they're like, "Oh my gosh, you're from Minnesota! Half our mainframes are from there."
Right? Yeah, they did totally talk about that. That was really cool. We'll post the link about it, because if you're ever in Seattle, you should check it out.
Yeah, we posted a couple of tweets when we were there too. You can see what nonsense we were up to.
Yeah.
It was a real, real good time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I got to make a punch card. And at PodCon, I got to meet Justin McElroy, and it was really great. And I didn't embarrass myself at all.
It's true. She didn't. She was very proud of that fact.
I'm just a normal fan who will never be remembered, which is exactly what you should be.
Well, it's great, because when we were at the end of PodCon, we walked back to our hotel. And we just walked within millimeters of all three of those boys.
Yeah.
Just in the lobby.
Right.
And a lot of other people did too. They were just standing around. And outside the context, nobody was daring enough to be oh, hi. Everyone was just these are normal people.
We totally saw them at the airport too, right?
They were on our flight home.
Yeah. That was something else.
I mean, they were in first class, but.
Oh, yeah. Right.
It was a McElroy filled weekend, which is all I wanted. So, but we did learn some stuff about how to improve our podcasts, and maybe what are some of the things we saw, some panels and stuff?
I went to a lot of ones about how to improve your podcast and such.
Mm-hmm.
I will talk about that in our Nice Games Club meetings.
Yeah.
If you're ever interested in making a podcast, I think that PodCon is pretty valuable for that, because there's a whole lot of people there who are not just enthusiastic about listening to them, but creating their own. I felt a lot of the people who were up, they did live podcasts, and a lot of them felt open and honest, and they had mm-hmm. question segments at the end, and it was lengthy ones. They were 10 minutes, 15 minutes. So it was a good time, good opportunity to ask people how they did things. Or what went well, what didn't go well. So I think it was very valuable.
Yeah. Wow. There were two kinds of, actually the workshop stuff was pretty thin.
Yeah,
I would say.
That's true.
That's my only feedback for them is I think a lot of the people who were there either definitely had podcasts or just started them. And they all had like, you know, very few listeners or like a small audience like us.
Yeah.
And so, but they also, big overlap, also consisted of huge fans of the podcasts that were doing live shows there. So I'm pretty sure everybody had a great time and got a lot what they wanted. But I think that they, so they probably won't hear this a lot, but I think they should have more workshop content. I think a lot of the existing audience would benefit from that. Mm-hmm. They had one track, so there was always one going on, but only ever one.
Yeah.
And that was kind of just a hair disappointing. But there was a lot of really good stuff. The stuff they had was great. And there were two kinds of things that I saw. One were like, you know, technical stuff, like what, you know, how to manage your mics and what equipment to use and what not to spend money on. Stuff, yeah. Little, you know, tips and tricks. And then also things like promotion, like how do you get an audience? How do you like, how do you structure your show in a way that becomes sellable, or how do you get sponsors and things like that?
Yeah.
And those were sort of interesting. And I feel like our show, we got a lot of technical stuff down. We've been doing this long enough. Mm-hmm. And what was kind of nice is at those talks, like I didn't really learn a lot, but it was actually really nice to sort of hear things that we figured out on our own.
Yeah.
Being parroted back to us by people who had made it. They're like, oh, great. It's not going to, you know, make us huge that we figured that out, but like we don't need to worry about that. Mm-hmm. And that was kind of nice. One of the only McElroy things I went to was one of them did a thing called Watch Me Cut, where he edited a piece or just showed the what he did, kind of almost as like he kind of described it as like a sort of like a, well, if I can do it, you can do it kind of thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, Stephen, you were there with me.
Yes.
And basically like they're using some janky stuff. Yeah. And just thinking like, oh wow, they kind of don't know what they're doing. And so it made me kind of like, oh, that's great. But also, that's terrible. Like, it kind of was both. But I don't know. There's very mixed feelings about that.
Well, it was like redeeming, at least for me. I was like, oh, we're just doing everything right. Technically, we're fine.
Right. It put a lot of things in context that I thought was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, that was very good. Like, I like that aspect of it. Like it, the whole conference, like it just put things in.
Yeah,
into perspective, which was
and it was a really well like run show, like as a bit of entertainment, like they did opening and closing shows.
Yeah,
it was actually just a really fun, like well put together with the resources they had, kind of thing. It was pretty easy to get around. It was well, there was signs posted well, like for a small conference. They like they ran it really well, so good for them, you know.
Well done, PodCon.
Mm-hmm.
Awesome. And then we also did the Global Game Jam.
Right, that was last week.
Yes. I was kind of stressed out about it before I started the actual jam. I was like, oh man, this is going to be a whole weekend. Oh, I got to make this game. Oh, what am I going to do? Oh, I just moved into this new place. Oh, I got to move all this crap and I haven't done all that yet. Oh, I was really stressed out about it. But like, and then I did it and it was just fine.
Mm-hmm.
which is great.
Well, you're both going to have to tell me about it because I got there and I was really sick. And then I left after an hour. And I didn't go back. So I'm basically missed out on the whole thing. So you guys have to tell me about your games, tell me about the process, tell me about the venue, tell me about everything.
Sure. So I made a game that was like, I really wanted to make a 3D game. So I worked with Rachel Peterson. We've had her on the show before. It's not short.
She made assets for me on last year's goal.
That's right. Yeah. Yes. And so we worked together to make, she made 3D models for this game as well. And we made like a 3D exploration game. Actually, before the Global Game Jam's theme this year was What Home Is to You or something like that.
What Home Means to You.
Yeah. And so our game is called Home Is What You Make of It, which is literally you go out into space and you gather a bunch of objects and then you bring it back to home and then you put them in the space. So you make your own home. It was cool because like I got to explore, movement in 3D, which I've never done before.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned how to like project 3D objects on the UI, which was that was a whole struggle for me. My brother helped me a little bit with it because it had some weird effects things going on with it, which was strange.
You mean like a screen to world space kind of stuff?
No, like I used render textures to and then like I was recording, I had another camera on where the 3D models were.
Oh yeah. Okay.
And then I and then I just portrayed that on the UI of it.
Cool.
It's really cool. And it ended up working out really well. But that was the game we made. It was a team of four, I think. One of the people we were working with was working remotely. Did the music. And then another person, Lowell, who he helps with the voice recordings at the game jam. He was also on our team. Mm-hmm. And he helped build, like, he built the world he put all the things where they needed to, or put all the things in his artistic vision, and it was really nice. Like a lot of the things that he made were really cool with the stuff that Rachel gave him. So it worked out really well for me, I think.
And you finished on time? You got a build up?
Yeah, we were ahead of schedule. I think we were like ready to go. Maybe I would say we were ready to go 2 hours, and then we were just like adding small bits and pieces there and fixing random things. And then we were ready in about 30 minutes before it ended.
Wow.
Which was nice.
Yeah.
Martha, how did it go for you?
Yeah, it went really well. I also was nervous about it because I was like, oh my God. Yeah, so tired.
Yeah.
And I was just getting over being sick at PodCon. So that was interesting. But, and it was nice because I already had a team. We had formed a team on the Slack beforehand. Yeah. So that whole stress was out. Instead of being at the like pitches and the team building thing, we went to a like cafe and just talked about what we wanted the game to be.
Yeah.
Which was really fun. And I ended up being a writer on the game, which is why my topic today is writing for games.
Did this segue into the topic?
I guess so, because I want to talk about the jam a lot in topic.
Before we do that, I do want to bring up like the Global Game Jam, like the venue and stuff. It was very different this year because we used to have it on the University of Minnesota's campus, but they changed their policies. So we weren't allowed to have people there over the 48 hours during the night.
Yeah.
So we had to try. It was a huge scramble to find a new venue, and we ended up finding one in St. Paul at the TPT building, and it was way smaller than it ever was. But it ended up working out okay, I think, right? Mm-hmm. We ended up having enough space for people.
It was nice because it was very defined where you could or could not be. Like, that was one of the things at the other building that was difficult, is like there's a bunch of rooms that you weren't supposed to go into, and then you got in trouble for being in them, and also there's a lot of places for people to just like squirrel off, and I don't know. It was nice being all in one room. It
felt like a group.
Yeah.
Yeah, which was neat.
So I guess for listeners who don't know, Global Game Jam is a global game jam.
Yes.
But there are local sites in cities all over the world. And so Glitch organizes the Twin Cities space. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, not, you wouldn't say official Twin Cities space, but it's the one that happens here, right? And anyone can put up a venue and list it, but Glitch is the one who steps up and does it for us in this community.
Yeah.
And that's what Steve was talking about. Yes. The previous place on campus had served us well, but had some quirks. So the TPT, the local PBS affiliate, they've been partnering with Glitch on a lot of stuff. Mm-hmm. They hosted GlitchCon this year, this most recent year. And they have this lovely lobby with this presentation space.
Yeah.
That isn't quite as big as the atrium in the previous building, but is really nice. Mm-hmm. It's a great place. And they're a good partner. And so they sort of like, last minute they worked it out to allow a bunch of random people to be there for 48 hours.
Right.
Which is really, really good. It's amazing. It's a big ask. Mm-hmm. And they stepped up and said yes.
Yeah.
So it was very cool of
them. Yes. Thank you so much for that. Mm-hmm. I think that it went well. I mean, I haven't heard any feedback contrary. It seemed like people were satisfied with it. I think that because of all of the last minute thing, I think our specific venue, the turnout was less than there was in the past. I'm not positive on that, though.
Well, there was a shorter time for people to sign up.
Right.
So I think it probably ended up working out with the smaller size of the place a little bit.
Yeah.
But there were still a ton of people there.
Oh, yeah. No, it was packed. Especially the first night. I think people started working home remotely after the first night, but like the first night it was packed. I think we also had some like remote developers too, who were, I think maybe even some teams who worked remotely, which ended up working out okay.
Yeah. Well, the Rachel, who you mentioned, helped organize with some other people on the Discord.
Yes.
People working remotely who had just planned to work remotely. And so there was, I think, I'm not sure how much it happened, but there was a lot of openness to having teams that were split between people working at the site and working from home and cross-pollinization and stuff. There's a lot more avenues of communication.
Yeah, I mean, we even had that. So, I think that was really a strength of it. Mm-hmm. Something that I felt like we didn't really have last year anyways, is like an online presence, which is really neat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And there were 29 games that were posted?
Yes, I believe.
From that site?
I believe so, mm-hmm. Which is pretty great.
So we'll put the link for it so you can play all of those.
Yeah, also we will, Glitch will be having a play party in the near future. I don't know all the details yet, but we'll maybe by the no, probably not by the time this thing is out.
Steven, this episode is the most timely episode we've ever recorded.
I know, I'm sorry.
Now is the time to tell people how many days from now it is and be basically accurate.
I just literally don't know. Well, it'll happen one day.
Keep an eye out on the Glitch channels.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, writing for games.
Yes. Oh, you already did your transition.
I did. Now it's done. It. But it's okay. It wasn't very good anyway. So,
good.
So yeah, at the Global Game Jam, I was a writer for the first time. I've like been trying to write my own game, but I haven't really gotten anything down on paper yet. Mm-hmm. It's mostly been like brainstorming and like no actual dialogue yet. So this is the first time I actually wrote like a complete dialogue thing, and it was really, really fun, but yeah. Also really, really hard, and like it was way harder than I thought it was gonna be. But like at the same time, I also felt bad because I felt like I wasn't doing anything, like I didn't code anything, and so I was like, I'm being lazy. I'm just sitting here trying to think of things, so it looked like I'm just sitting here.
You know, in that 1 hour I was there, you did tell me I am not going to code this weekend. So I don't know how bad you felt about it.
Oh, hey. Both feelings can exist at the same time. Mm-hmm. I'm glad I wasn't coding,
right.
But I can also feel guilty that I wasn't coding and I didn't want to be.
I felt that.
Because, like, I don't know. I think people think that the coding is the hardest part because... Hmm. Like, you have to know the most technical training stuff to make all the stuff in Unity work. Because it's not the most intuitive thing ever.
Yeah.
So if you're doing something that's in the more creative side of it, it can feel weird. But...
Yeah, it's a different, like...
It's a different type of work. It's like,
yeah.
It's like all... it's creativity, so you have to wait for, like, ideas to come together.
Right, yeah, that's what I was going to say. Yeah, like, it's a... workflow isn't the right word, but like, yeah, how the things get created, there's some period of time when you need to like create the thing, whereas with coding you're constantly, there's like a bar constantly moving forward. I guess that you can almost say the same thing about art, but like there's always that first starting process where you have to figure out what the heck you're doing.
Yeah, I kind of feel totally the opposite. I feel like they're exactly the same.
Oh, okay.
Like when you're trying to come up with you're trying to build an architecture for whatever you need to do.
Yeah.
Like, that requires a little bit of sit down and thinking on it.
You're totally right. I think I'm approaching it from, like, in a game jam, I'm like, code, quick. And
right.
Immediately, I don't even think about it too much. And then I'm like, oh, why did I do this stupid thing 5 hours into the jam?
There's probably also, to play devil's advocate, your position is, there's also probably a couple of things that you just, like, you have to do.
Yeah.
And so you could keep yourself busy with some of the, like, just have to tasks.
Yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah. But you're totally right. You do need to plan out your architecture, especially when you're, like, trying to, if you're not doing a game jam game and you're trying to finish this thing. You want to make sure you do some planning ahead of time so that doesn't come to bite you in the rear end later.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always felt engineering is a creative act.
Totally is.
Just as much as anything else.
I suppose it does feel different to the process felt different to me than other game jams.
Yeah,
there are other roles that I've done because like, well, I suppose it is pretty similar, but I felt like I was using a different part of my brain.
Yeah,
because I was trying to come up with like narrative characters. Like one of the things that I found really interesting is because like your character can only say so many things. So you have to get their personality out through like it's like a haiku. You have to like par down the words to just the ones you need basically, but also make them distinct from all the other characters. Like not, cause that was a hard time too. Cause so I guess I should explain the game.
Yes.
We ended up writing. The other interesting, so I'll just tell about it and then tell how it came about.
Okay.
So the story is that you play an old lady who's also a witch who shows up at a polar research station and makes everyone happy by granting their wish by combining items into other items and then giving it to them.
Okay.
And then everyone plays D&D and is happy. The end.
Where does home fit in all of this?
Well, originally
okay,
originally our idea, like that's the thing about having a group beforehand, mm-hmm. is that it solved the problem of there isn't one designer going around trying to say, oh, here's my idea. I'm going to sell you on my idea. And if you like my idea, you come and join me. And that person kind of takes point on the like idea of the game and the narrative of the game. Has creative control of the band.
Right. Yeah.
But when we had a group like already formed with no one person designated as like the creative control person, we spent so much time trying to like negotiate on what the game was going to be. And so it went through so many iterations, and the end thing is a kind of a amalgamation of everyone's ideas. Mm. So that's why it's kind of lots of things cobbled together and okay. not really on the theme because it's, yeah.
I mean, that's fine. It's not like Global Game Jam's a competition. And also, even if it was, you could do whatever you want.
It's true. Well, the game started out, like the first idea was like what your game ended up being of like, oh, you live in a bunker and you have to go out and get stuff to make it feel like home. And like all these characters are, you know, really, really sad. And then you get like decorate their house to be all beautiful and homely and, you know, like warm, and then they are happy.
Yeah.
And that morphed into
to what it is now.
Yeah. So yeah.
Cool.
So yeah, there's pros and cons to like collaborating that way. Mm-hmm. Because on the one hand, like everyone's ideas got in there, but on the other hand, like the overall cohesiveness of it was not there.
But so you fill the role of the writer. And
yes.
So how was that process like? How did that go?
So I worked really closely with Aaron, our artist, one of our artists, the character artist anyway, to come up with like interesting characters. So we came up with like who each scientist at the station was going to be and like what was their thing.
Yeah.
So the like thing that they wished for, the witch combined two things that made a pun.
Yeah.
So like the one person wanted a pineapple, so we combined an apple and a pine cone. And another person wanted the book The Count of Monte Cristo, so you combined a Monte Cristo sandwich with an abacus.
Okay.
And yeah, so etc.
Yes. Oh, I remember there was one where it was like the gold one.
Oh, yes. So there's a pile of 12 carrots and you find another pile of 12 carrots and you put them together and they form 24 karat gold.
Perfect.
Yeah. So basically we came up with the puns first and then made characters up for them.
Yeah.
So we had like a like professor person who liked reading and a person who like really missed their partner. And so like a pineapple reminded them of their honeymoon in Hawaii. Mm-hmm. And like one person like missed their grandma and they lost their magic amulet that their grandma gave them. Mm-hmm. So we decided like, because of the constraints of the game jam being so short that we were just going to have one thing that they say, if you hadn't given them the right thing, like, oh, I'm sad.
Yeah.
And then one thing that they say when they are given the thing that's right. And then a opening cutscene and a closing cutscene. That's it. We had many more like ideas of like having interstitial like things when you walk by them or when you pick something up, other people commenting on the like
that item.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Or like, ugh, why are you giving me this? Like if you gave them the wrong thing, but we ended up just being like, you can't give them a thing. If you have the right thing and walk up to them, then they're like, oh, you gave it to me. Yay.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Cool.
So it was cool, like collaborating with Aaron on stuff because, like the way the narrative was going informed how she was drawing the characters and how the characters were drawn kind of informed how I wrote them. So that was pretty fun.
Yeah. That's cool because I know that in a lot of games, like the narrative team will get brought on partway through development instead of in the beginning of the process, and it makes it difficult to like patch things together in a way that makes sense mm-hmm. for the game. Whereas if they were in the beginning of the process, they could have helped with some of the decision making, and then like the game would be different, but like maybe better for it, because at least then the narrative and the design and the game design would be meshed.
And you always hear a lot of stories of like this gameplay element influenced the narrative, and then it all fit together really nicely. But less often do you hear the other way around, mm-hmm. where like this narrative like conceit, this point, this needs to be delivered. How do we do that with gameplay?
Right.
Because by that point, that ends up being too big an ask, you know, to modify.
Yeah.
And so working within tandem, then they just, you know, they don't ask too much of the other.
Right.
Right. They develop in tandem.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I imagine you had that experience then.
Yes.
Cool.
Yeah. It was really cool. And not just with the art people, but also with the coders, like, oh, what should we do this game mechanic? Does that make sense with these characters? And the voice actors, like, how do you want these people to sound? We just got people to say grunts and stuff. So you walk up and they go, oh. So that was really interesting, like directing voice actors to sound the way that you want them to. Mm-hmm. It was just really cool to like collaborate with other people.
Yeah, that's good. That makes a lot of sense. I don't have any experience at all really writing games. All of the writing in Fingence and Widget Satchel is not mine. It's somebody else on the team. I just read it.
Well, I think you're selling yourself a little short. Uh-huh. I mean, when we've had lots of, or like last year, it seems so long ago now, mm-hmm. but we would talk about the story and structure of a Widget Satchel, and we brainstormed a lot of that together, and a lot of the ideas in there are yours.
That's true, yeah, I did have some, I had creative input and such. I didn't do the act of
writing. It all sort of like blends into the final form,
yeah.
So maybe you don't remember exactly, but like, you know, but you do have more of a hand in that than you think.
That's true. Yeah, I mean, we involved it in earlier on in the process, so mm-hmm. like that's, I didn't even realize that I had that role, but I did have have parts of it. Yeah.
And that's a lot of times the difference is that you the writing, the dialogue, the letters on the screen is not really the major work of writing a game.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point. I think that's important because that is influenced a lot by, the creative decisions that you made mm-hmm. during the process and such.
Like Martha, when you're describing this, the concept, which is that these people need these two things, they need something to make them happy. And the mechanic that supports that is this sort of pun based combination system, right? So you have two elements there. You have the we're going to make these jokes, right? And that's writing. And then we're going to have this sort of like fulfillment narrative, this sort of like helping other people. And none of that is like, that's well before you actually write a single word or come up with a single pun for it.
Yeah.
But that seems like the main work of that story.
Yeah. Oh man. Coming up with the puns was so hard.
Yeah.
Cause we were all like super tired and we're like, we don't feel funny, but we really want these puns in here.
Yeah.
So, and they couldn't be just like puns, like, cause so many puns are just like, this word happens to rhyme with this word and wasn't conducive to the combining two things thing. So it was like not even, it was like a specific type of pun that we were trying to come up with. Mm. So yeah, but that was the hardest part was coming up with like those things first and then writing the dialogue. Like the last character that I wrote was one that he doesn't say very much and is like really grumpy, and like after writing all the other ones, it took me like 5 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I'd like agonized over like every single one, like finally I'd gotten enough like creative momentum or something that it was just like, oh yeah, like here's a joke. Oh, that's funny. Ha ha.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And he ended up being like kind of the best one. So.
Yeah. Cool.
So what are some puns you rejected that weren't good enough?
Ooh.
Oh, well, there was one that we were going to do like blue jeans and because it was a lab. So there'd be like genetic material and like blue dye for dyeing specimens.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And then you could find blue jeans.
Yeah.
But
you opted not to take that route?
Yes.
Is it because you didn't have enough time or was it too bad a pun?
Well, we couldn't fit it into the narrative because we didn't like none of the characters that we had made at that point like would want pants.
Oh,
so okay. It's that kind of outpost.
Yeah, I mean they're supposed to be all like professional, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
They're not wearing jeans.
Right.
I don't know. We just couldn't. Let me look at the document. It's probably more.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, you had a document?
Oh, yeah. So we had a Google Doc that we like wrote ideas down in, and it's very incomprehensible unless you were there.
But that's smart and clever, especially for a game jam. Keeps you organized.
Oh, yeah. I highly recommend having some sort of collaborative document. Maybe
even just as like a place to put thoughts.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. It was really helpful because I ended up going home early and working from home for half of it.
Right.
And like it made it super easy to collaborate that way too. So
that's smart.
Plus also get version control. That also helps with collaborating.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to do a Dungeons and Dragons pun, it looks like, but didn't really work because we couldn't. Aaron thought maybe dragon fruit plus Funyuns, like Funyuns and dragons.
Yep.
That didn't really
That's
work.
That's a tough sell. Yeah.
I think we used all of the rest of them.
So you have this collaborative doc. And so tell me a little bit more about the workflow. Like, what did it take to round trip some of this stuff?
Yeah.
Like actually getting it into the build.
Oh, yeah. One cool thing I learned was about scriptable objects in Unity.
Oh, yeah.
So Charles made these really cool dialogue objects that could be used for anybody talking. So basically, there was a script that defined all the characters. And then when you were looking at a dialogue object in the inspector in Unity, there would be a little drop down with all the characters. So you'd be like, okay, this character is talking, like the player is talking to, you know, Zelda. Mm. And then there's a like enum or whatever array, and you could tell it how many pieces of dialogue you're going to have in that dialogue. So like, they're going to talk, have five pieces of dialogue back and forth. And then that would populate five different form fields.
Oh,
for what they would say. And you could say, Zelda is going to say hello. And then the player says, hi. Mm-hmm. And then the next one you could assign, and you can have multiple people in the same dialogue. So it could be three people. And then each piece of dialogue, you say who's going to say it.
So you could just build a scene just right in the inspector.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And so that's exactly how cutscenes and widgets actually work.
Oh.
With a drop down for characters and then, how many lines and exactly like that. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I think that's how it works in Fingence. I'm pretty sure Charles grabbed it from that.
Probably.
It's a game.
Together very quickly.
But that's cool. And then it just allows you to just, put your writing into the thing and you don't have to touch any of the code or anything like that.
It was super easy to do.
Yeah, it lets you change it too without getting in the way of anybody else's workflow.
Yeah.
Right, exactly, because the dialogue system, like the code itself, pulls in that object and then just reads what's ever there. Yeah. So, and pulls in the sprites for the characters and everything. And so, I can go in and edit things now and it won't break the game. So,
yeah.
It's really fun.
Cool.
Yeah, scriptable objects are, when you start using them, at first you're like, this is an extra abstraction layer I don't need right now. And then when you realize what they can do and where it can save you time down the road, it becomes really, really attractive to use it for everything.
Yeah.
Then you got to pull back a little bit. Yeah. But
it's like that joke is like glass with half full water, half empty of water.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like, optimist, it's half full. Pessimist, it's half empty. And software engineer, what if we made a glass that could hold anything?
That is literally my brother.
I mean, we don't need it to hold lava, but what if someday we did?
So, as a result, then Charles and Lane were the coders in the project. Okay. The way you interacted was through those scriptable objects?
Yes.
Okay, cool. And it didn't get in there. I guess it was a benefit because then they could just focus on the code too.
Yeah. So, and I was the one who put in all the dialogue and all the tooltips for the, Like I placed all like Lowell did for your game, placed all the stuff.
Cool.
So yeah, it was really fun. Yeah. Highly recommend trying out writing sometime if you have never done it before. It's very like it makes you see that side way better.
Yeah.
I guess this isn't really advice for people. It's just my experience, but
do it. <What? laughs>
Well, I mean, if you're new to it, and you're not new to writing,
no,
by any stretch. But if that's something you want to try and you haven't found a way to try it, Game Jam's a good place.
Yeah,
right. Very true. Because you can get help, and you can really just fill it with puns.
Yeah, and make a ridiculous story about polar explorers.
Yeah. So tell me, just before we end this topic, tell me a little bit about the game itself. Like, it's like RPG style looking, like...
Kind of. We had Phil, who does 3D modeling, mm-hmm. and he's so good at it. And he made the
map.
The map. And it was so cool. Like, they had open, like doors that opened and closed, yeah. mm-hmm. and like a little stairway. And when you walk down the stairway, the upper level like flew out of the scene, and oh, when you walked back up the stairs, that came back down.
Cool.
So cool.
Yeah.
And so he did the environment stuff. We had another artist, Jajiv, mm-hmm. who did drew all of the like items you pick up, mm-hmm. and so we had 3D space, but all the stuff that was in it was 2D.
Oh, cool.
So your character walked around like isometrically.
Yeah.
2D and never like turned around.
Oh, that's cool.
So
what's the name of it so people can find it on the site?
Oh, it is One Polar Night. And the build that's up there right now, as of Saturday, uh-huh. Is a little bit broken, I think, still. So you can pick up items and you can combine items, but the other items that you combine to make the new item don't go away.
Oh. So
it was so cool because at the end of the jam, like the main game mechanic of combining items was yeah. like not in the game yet, and it was oh. like 5 minutes left. And so Lane and Charles were like pair programming on a computer, like oh. with the clock, like counting down.
Oh my
and goodness. There's a whole ton of us, like just like an audience started forming around them. And so like, yeah. Oh my gosh, okay, decode this. Oh no, that's not working. Okay, put a breakpoint there. Okay, and run. No, it's still the same. Okay, go there.
It's like y'all were at NASA or something.
Yeah. It's like this was mission control.
Yeah, wow, that's cool.
Yeah. So, but we're gonna work on it a little bit this weekend. Well, they are. I'm doing other stuff, but I'm gonna work from home a little bit, fixing some of the dialogue mistakes because I'm not a very good speller, and scriptable objects don't spell check.
For yeah.
So, but yeah, go check it out. It's called One Polar Night.
Cool.
All right, we'll move on to my topic. My topic is copyright in the public domain. Less exciting, I guess, but really timely because
if you write a game and you want other people to be you want other people to be able to remix yep. it and use it, or even just like make their own version of it, you might want to put it in the public domain or have a like Creative Commons thing. Okay, go.
Okay. this year, for the first time in 20 years, something entered the public domain.
Oh,
yay!
Wait, what thing?
All works,
yeah.
Creative works that registered from 1922.
Oh, wow.
23, that's right. The last time anything entered the public domain was stuff from 1922, uh-huh. and that happened in 1998.
Oh, my goodness.
So the way this thing, now, we're all, you guys are younger than me, but I'm even too young to remember this as a tradition. Mm. But it used to be every year there would be like a celebration of like the things entering the public domain this year.
Oh.
And for the last 20 years, that's not happened.
Yeah.
And the reason is because copyright...
Disney is evil.
We'll get there. copyright protections were extended mm-hmm. in 1998. It was a law that just did just that. That was all it did.
Oh.
From 75 to 95 years.
Yeah.
And so it just padded on 20 years to pre-existing works.
Uh-huh.
And so now that we've gone through those 20 years... things are starting to enter the public domain again. So next year it'll be 1924 and 5 and so on.
Cool.
Until a few years from now, and this is where a lot of the headlines about this is coming, the first Mickey Mouse cartoon will enter the public domain.
Steamboat
Willie, that's yeah. right. And Disney was a huge proponent of extending copyright protections throughout the century. Because a little history here, copyright protection originally at the founding of this country was 28 years. Oh. So very frequently you would outlive the protection on your works, right? Mm-hmm. In the 20th century, by the middle of the 20th century, that had doubled. I don't have the details on that specifically, but we'll link a bunch of resources on this. You can look up the details.
Yeah.
But it became 56 years. The reason why it was doubled then, I think probably was that there was the purpose of copyright had changed a little bit, and copyright protections had become more central to the economy.
Oh.
Basically, in ye olden days, everything was like an epic poem, right? Like you shared art and works, and also something like a painting was not easily copyable.
Yeah.
So the idea of a copyright it didn't make a lot of sense until you had mass distribution of creative works.
Yeah.
And a copyright protection legally it's a total artifice, right? It's something invented by governments, mm-hmm. and the reason it exists is very similar to patent protection. So if people are familiar with patent law, at least a little bit, patents are public, right? I make an invention, and I tell the whole world exactly how it works.
Right.
And now that's dangerous, right? Because then they can make it themselves. Yeah. But the reason I do that is because in exchange for revealing my secrets, I get legal protection for them. I can sure. exclusively exploit them.
Yeah.
And that's a huge part of patent law. But it's what's great about it is that when patents expire, then they become available to everyone to use. Whereas if I were to invent something and then sell it for a couple of years, then my business goes, I go out of business, and then I die and all of my equipment gets, you know, washed away to sea or whatever.
Sure, yeah.
And then my knowledge is lost to history.
Yeah.
And so that is one of the reasons why patent law exists. Now, copyright is different because, I mean, it's a similar structure, but like when you make something, the point is to get it out there, right?
Right. Yeah.
So, but it they are related in that same way, in that in exchange for you distributing it widely, basically for taking that risk, mm-hmm. you get legal protection.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, 20-odd years, 50-odd years, and it's just been inching up as copyright protection became more and more important to the livelihood of a lot of these companies.
Sure.
Like, you know, and I think the Disney is evil is a really, like, a handy narrative and mostly true. But imagine if you are, you know, making a work that is a series, right? You're not making new characters every year. And this is just up to you, right? There's no right or wrong way to do it.
Yeah.
But if there were no copyright protections that were long enough to span your career, for example, mm-hmm. then you would be forced to pivot at a time when it was maybe inconvenient for you.
Sure.
Because all of a sudden, the works you had would be less exploitable.
Yeah.
And so, it's a lot of debate as to what because it's a one-size-fits-all solution, right? Mm-hmm. And so, the arguments that inched it up over time were very much, they made a lot of sense to a lot of people. It wasn't a huge power grab, exactly. Mm-hmm. That said, the law from 1998, total power grab.
Like yeah.
At that point, it was 75 years.
Oh,
now, there's a difference between copyright protections for an author, an individual author, and for a company that owns a copyrighted work, because the law treats them as the same in a sense. Like the ownership, like you'll see at the end of a movie, it says, for the purposes of copyright, this work was created by Sony or Disney or whatever.
Sure.
And now that's silly because a company can't do a creative thing. Mm. But for legal purposes, they own the copyright, right? So that's what all that like legal sort of mumbo jumbo is about.
Okay.
In terms of how they're protected in courts, it's the same. But the law does distinguish between an author and a rights holder in such that an author gets copyright protection for their lifetime plus a certain amount of time.
Mm.
So currently, if you make something and you just exploit it on your own, you own the copyright. You have some company distributed or whatever, but it's your copyright. You have it for your life.
Yeah.
Right? It doesn't expire in your lifetime. Plus a certain number of years so your descendants can continue to exploit it for a certain amount of time.
Yeah.
The amount of time that is certainly like what is the correct time is debatable. Now, if you're just a company and you own something, companies don't get buried in the cemetery. So those copyrights do expire. And they expire currently 95 years after they're created.
Mm-hmm.
Now that difference for authors, I'm flipping around in the timeline here, but in 1976, the copyright law was changed. So okay. Before that time, copyright protection was just those 56 years for everybody for all things. After that, it was changed, it was split so that you'd have the authors and companies would do it differently, right? For the most part, I don't think there's a lot of backlash against the idea that a copyright should live with an author for that author's lifetime.
Yeah.
The plus so many years, I think, is a lot, there's a lot of debate about.
Okay.
I think there's a fair debate to be had about whether a copyright should include the life of an author. I could easily fall on either side of those, you know, depending, but I think it's a fair argument to have. Not a lot of people are having that argument.
Yeah.
The argument people are definitely having, though, is how long a company should be able to exploit a piece of work that's like a million years old.
Right.
And Disney is, of course, the main focus point of this because they are about the only company from the 1920s in the creative space that still has going concerns with those same creative works.
Mm-hmm.
It's an unusual situation.
Yeah.
But as a result of their desire to protect their works, because they didn't want a bunch of other people distributing Mickey Mouse cartoons.
Yeah.
I mean, maybe they should have been able to, but you could understand why they wouldn't want that.
Right.
But as a result, tons of works from the early century have been like denied from the public domain. And not only is that something where people can't republish it or can't make derivative works, but it also limits access to it.
Mm-hmm.
Because public domain, it doesn't just mean that it's free to exploit. It also means it's free to own. Right, you don't have to pay for a copy.
Yeah,
right. If you can get your hands on it, it's yours.
Yeah,
and so that has a lot of things, especially music in the early part of the 20th century. A lot of that stuff is just sort of like being held by like Warner Brothers or other rights holders,
mm-hmm.
And they're not being exploited because no one would buy them, right? Mm-hmm. So but in the public domain, there'd be more interest. And so it's been a bit of a tragedy in that sense.
So you keep using the term exploited.
Yes.
And I'm curious why you're saying exploited instead of like used or...
I mean, I'm just using it as a technical term.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Oh, no, I know. It's not like a negative thing.
Right.
It sounds like a positive thing every time you say it, which is great. But I mean like... So the technical term is just like to use a product?
Well, and exploiting, like, I mean, I'm just... There's not like a definitive... I'm just using that phrase because... Yeah. If I'm exploiting my work, it means usually means I'm selling it. I'm gaining from its use.
Okay.
Not just using it.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm getting something in return for its use.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
That's usually what that means.
Cool.
Generally, it just means putting it for sale.
Yeah.
For the most part.
That's cool.
But it also means like licensing, or it means if you own the copyright, that means you can prevent other people from copying it, including yourself.
Mm.
Right. If you have the copyright to a work, you can keep it from the world.
Yeah.
Right. That's your choice. And so without the copyright, other people could do it. So copyright is as much about you exploiting a work as it is about preventing others from exploiting the work.
Okay.
And it's basically because you are the artist, you own it, you get to decide.
Yeah.
And that's an important concept, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's an important concept to the development of creative arts in a way that's different from culturally what it was before the notion of copyright. And so those protections are important. And certainly... this is just a general interest topic, but we'll tie it into games a little bit later. But mm-hmm. the sort of the preview of that is that, game developers are some of the most at risk of their works being stolen and exploited by others because copyright protections are very weak when it comes to things like game mechanics and stuff like
that. Yeah.
So we'll get into that as well.
Mm-hmm. I was reading on the Public Domain Day website or whatever, mm-hmm. how like stuff from the 90s could have been like published, or someone could have taken up the mantle of all these things that have just been left, like no one's working on them.
Yeah, it's called orphaned.
Yeah, orphaned. Orphan, that's
orphaned works.
Mm.
And so a lot of that is things that they could be the source of a remixed work or a derivative work or an inspiration or something, but not only can they not be accessed and exploited by future artists, a lot of times they're just hard to find.
Sure.
And that becomes very difficult. It also means the legacies of certain artists who are not commercially popular in this day become lost because it's harder for like libraries to stock them.
Yeah.
Libraries can stock anything, but there are physically fewer copies.
Right.
Like because of that. So these all have add-on effects. And a lot of in gaming, people are familiar with the term abandonware,
mm-hmm.
right? Software that a creator has stopped working on or stopped selling, and that's a relatively new concept in the time frames we're talking about. But it has a lot of the same things. People will distribute abandonware on torrent sites without any sort of ethical qualms because they feel they're not hurting anybody.
Yeah.
And that's generally true. But at the same time, what if who's to say if someone didn't abandon it on purpose? Right?
Right.
And so it becomes very kind of tricky. But a lot of these orphaned works, it's pretty unambiguous. It's like there's nobody there to protect them. They're owned by some conglomerate media corporation, or they're owned by a family that just has no interest in doing anything with it, mm-hmm. but also wouldn't necessarily object to other people doing it, but like isn't going to volunteer it freely. Yeah. So it becomes very tricky, and these are all very case by case in a lot of these situations. There are a couple of famous things that just entered the public domain on accident, which is sort of interesting. Ayn Rand, everybody's favorite terrible author, wrote a novella called Anthem. And I read this in high school, and it's a very short concept. It's amazing how short it is, considering it's an Ayn Rand work. But, it was developed, it was published, I believe, as a serial in a magazine. I don't remember the exact history of it, but through, like, they just forgot to file for copyright extension, which is a thing you used to have to do. And so it was just, it just entered the public domain before these protections were enacted. And so a lot of times, the things about the when the copyrights were extended, it didn't take anything out of the public domain. It just extended retroactively things that were not yet in the public domain. So things that were already in the public domain, either through that normal process or by accident, stayed there. Mm. And so that's a pretty famous example. And so there are lots of so you can just get a copy. Anyone can publish the book. It's sort of interesting because particularly Ayn Rand, who is like an ardent libertarian, it's sort of a fun, anyway. but there's a couple of examples of things that you'll find, like certain songs that just forgot to re-enter their extensions and stuff like that. Very recently, the song Happy Birthday. You never heard it on TV, you know, because it was always He's a Jolly Good Fellow. The only reason we know He's a Jolly Good Fellow is because that's what people sang on television instead of Happy Birthday. Because Happy Birthday was there was a copyright claim on it, and that was actually thrown out in court recently. Mm. And so as recently as this year, there are TV shows now singing Happy Birthday to their characters. Finally, after all this time,
we can finally have a birthday,
right? But I think that would have gone into public domain in a couple years anyway.
Yeah,
but. I don't know. But anyways, so like there's a lot of these fun examples of different things. Yeah. But what's interesting is like what you can do with public domain works. So this is a really interesting element where you're like, oh, when Mickey Mouse becomes public domain, then suddenly everyone can just make Mickey Mouse stuff and whatever, do whatever they want. That's not actually true. The what goes into public domain will be Steamboat Willie.
Yeah.
And so Disney will certainly be interested in keeping an eye on whoever tries to exploit the public domain status of those characters and those elements. Sure. Steamboat Willie itself, you can have a copy and publish it. You can, I don't know, you could sell it, but who would buy it? Because it's free. That actual work is available. The characters, the concepts, like what actually is a work is actually kind of fraught in a sense. So for example, Mickey Mouse, like the design of the character from Steamboat Willie is actually very different from the modern design of Mickey Mouse.
Sure, yeah.
So what's going to happen, this is definitely going to happen, is when that character, because the character will become public domain along with the first thing.
Okay.
There will be lots of people licensing merchandise with Mickey Mouse.
Oh, yeah.
And it will be legal. Mm-hmm. But Disney will be checking every one of them for like the exact coloring, the do they have gloves or not, like all these things, and getting ready to sue those who go outside, and probably, you know, every edge case as well. And they're within every right to do that because they do own a lot of, because a lot of those creative, those that work was done a decade later, right? And it's not public domain.
Yeah.
And like the question is like, where's the line exactly, right? Like what is a creative decision and what isn't exactly? Steamboat Willie's a black and white cartoon.
Yeah.
So what color are Mickey's shorts?
Oh. Like
is that in the public domain? Like, because presumably in that time, they you know, there was a creative decision, like if it was ever in color or if we ever paint a mural or something, this is the color it will be. Mm-hmm. But is that part of the work that becomes public domain or not? These are not easy questions to answer.
Yeah.
Additionally, trademark is a very interesting component. So you can distribute Steamboat Willie once this comes in public domain in a few years. You can make your own Mickey Mouse cartoons, even name the character Mickey Mouse, but you cannot like use that three-headed logo that three-circled logo for your thing, because that symbol is actually a trademark of Disney. And trademarks don't expire. They're different from copyright. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people, when they're getting into working creatively, they sort of mix these concepts up.
I know I did.
So copyright is just a creative expression, a piece of work, right? Sure. And you don't have to register this anywhere. As soon as you create a piece of work, even if you don't show it to anybody in the universe, you have legal protections on it, right? Okay. Enforcing it's another matter. It's why you generally try to register your works with the Copyright Office.
Yeah.
A trademark is something else. You do have to apply for a trademark for the various governments in which you'd like to exploit that trademark. And then when the trademark's granted to you, it actually prevents other people from having similar trademarks or confusing marks. It's different. It is a piece of creative work in a sense, but it's not protected as a creative work. It's protected as a piece of trade, as your position in the marketplace.
Okay.
And so if somebody tries to sell Mickey Mouse cartoons, Disney's going to say, well, we have Mickey Mouse TM. Like, sorry, yeah. you can call them something else and you can use the character. I'm sure there'll probably be lots of lawsuits, but can you say a Mickey Mouse cartoon? I mean, technically it is, right?
Right.
But can you trade on the name Mickey Mouse?
Yeah.
It's kind of unknown. These are like new questions in a sense, because the interest of it, and when things enter the public domain, they sort of enter it whole cloth. Like, this is the first, it's becoming the idea of like the era of marketing as well as creative works being mixed together.
Yeah.
It's really, really fascinating.
Yeah.
Now the question is why, maybe what happens in a couple years when Steamboat Willie's on the chopping block, mm-hmm. is Disney just going to go back to Congress and say, I think it would be 150 years seems fair. actually, no, there's no indication that's going to happen.
Okay.
Partly because there's a lot more, corporate sentiment than there was in 1998.
Sure, yeah.
In 2012, there was a huge movement to stop SOPA. Does everyone remember that?
Yeah.
That was a law that was intended to allow copyright holders to enforce their works more aggressively on the internet.
Right.
There was a huge blackout of a bunch of different websites on a certain day to protest the potential ramifications. That got defeated. There's also sort of the pro-net neutrality movements. Basically, the public is more educated on what's at stake. Mm-hmm. Also, 95 years is a really long time. And I think even Disney would have a hard time arguing any good faith arguments that it should be longer than that.
Yeah.
The fact that they went from 75 to 95 is an incredible get.
Yeah.
But I feel like I'm not sure how much lobbying could actually convince any even like vulnerable senator to actually fall in line with that. And I imagine Disney is probably not even that interested in it either.
Yeah.
They're not, I mean, maybe they have like, you know, their own motives to protect their company at all costs. Mm. But like, I think you have to be pretty nefarious to like have a straight face to a certain point.
Yeah.
Right?
It's much less of a popular idea Yeah, you're right. The way you said it, like, people are more educated about it. So it is a very unpopular idea. Like, you see how people react to Nintendo, taking down remakes or whatever and stuff. And I'm sure Disney's looking at that and going, oh, maybe we shouldn't do something about this because it'll look really bad.
Yeah. And the truth is Disney's going to be protected by trademark laws and their bajillions of dollars.
Right.
So, like, they're not.
And everything they're buying, like, they own everything now. Yeah. So.
They're a diversified company at this point.
They're Monopoly.
It's so funny because, I watched Warner Brothers cartoons, like Bugs Bunny, but I've, I've seen maybe two Mickey Mouse cartoons. It's strange it's this sort of different echelon of like Disney's identity.
Yeah.
They are a very strange and singular company in American culture.
Mm-hmm.
But interestingly, a lot of times, especially when we talk about big business, when we're very critical of that, we feel that as a very uniquely American problem, mm-hmm. right? Mostly because the biggest businesses in the world are American.
Yeah.
And they tend to be the biggest problems. But in fact, a lot of the good faith arguments, if you can call them that, for the 1998 extension was that in the European Union, extensions were already longer.
Oh.
And so it was actually, that was one of the reasons why it was a little harder to mount an opposition, is because parity amongst all the nations of the world is very important for companies that distribute their works around the world.
Mm-hmm.
Software developers get their works pirated all the time in China, for example. Yeah. And so you see lots of companies trying to lobby the American government and the Chinese government to crack down on these things. And a lot of that is to go to multinational organizations like the World Trade Organization or the UN,
mm-hmm.
and say, like, let's have a standard we all agree on so that we can enforce these similarly. And of course, the only people who have the ability to sort of make those get those audiences are the ones who are mostly in favor of increasing those limits.
Sure.
But there is something to be said about having standards that are the same around the world. Otherwise, especially with the smaller world we live in, your copyright expires in Belgium. Well, then those things could be distributed to Americans.
Oh,
right.
Yeah.
And so if, you as a copyright holder are not just interested in the protections in your locality, but around the world.
Mm.
And it's increasingly so. It's maybe less a day-to-day concern for indie developers and indie filmmakers and so on, but it's a real thing.
Yeah.
And so you kind of have to see like, you understand why a lot of these companies are so protective of it because it can be a big, and you know, that's where they make their money. Like that's why they're huge companies. And so they are protecting what makes them the size they are.
Yeah.
But yeah, that 20-year extension is just egregious. And the thing is, it's never going back, right? Like people who celebrated the appearance of new works in the public domain this year, but nothing's changed, right? The law didn't revert or anything. Sometimes it's like, oh, things are better now. Like the 20-year ban expired. That's not what happened.
Yeah.
Still 95 years. It's going to be that way forever. I mean, as far as I know, there'd have to be a huge lobbying effort to roll those back. And I think that it'd be hard to imagine the interest that people would have in promoting that, because there's even amongst Creative Commons groups, pro net neutrality groups, it kind of doesn't feel like a real good use of their time. But it's kind of sad. I wish there was a constituency for rolling back those protections to like 55 years, which is still pretty long, right?
Yeah.
But there probably is never going to be. And particularly because a lot of times, like I said, those things got extended in America because they were already that way in Europe. And so I feel like that's never going to happen again. So we're kind of, but it is good every year that tradition's coming back. Every year there'll be new things in the public domain.
Yeah.
And I did want to talk about one example of something I used in a work of mine.
Oh.
And then we can talk a little bit about how, you know, maybe brainstorm some ideas of how game developers can sort of exploit some of these things.
Yeah.
But there's an Irving Berlin song called All By Myself, which was published in 1921. And so it's been in the public domain for 22 years or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I use that in a film of mine.
Ooh.
And I did a lot of research to see like, oh, I'd love to be able to use this. There's a sequence in a film I made where a character is sort of daydreaming. And then the people around her in her daydream, it's like a little musical moment.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really fun to do. But I was like, oh, it'd be really fun to have like everybody lip sync to this to a recording, have a scratchy record sound, and have that be part of the experience.
Yeah.
But as I was researching this, a lot of the recordings of this song were made in 1925.
Oh.
And so the recordings are not public domain, but the song itself, the sheet music, was published in 1921.
Okay.
And the song didn't become more popularly recorded until a little bit later. In fact, there were not even a lot of recordings in those days. And so had that extension not been done in 1998, I would have been able to do that originally. What I did instead is I recorded a new version of it. The actor who would be singing the song, I had them record the vocals. I did an original version of the song.
Cool.
And that was really fun to do, but it changed the character of the work I was making.
Oh yeah.
And I've always thought about that, like that the sort of world we live in and those elements and how far reaching the consequences of that stuff can be.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of times, one of the diversifiers for Global Game Jam was to use a newly, a piece of work that was newly placed in the public domain. And so there's definitely a lot of interest among game designers and developers to do something with this now that we've got it again, now that there are new things. It's also renewing interest in older works that have been in the public domain for a long time.
I kind of hope they do that every year, because like that would be really cool, just so people see that as an option and they think of it as an option.
Yeah. And it's not just about like taking a piece of work and putting it in your own work. It's about coming up with derivative works and taking elements and characters and doing sequels, right? Anybody on the planet can write a Sherlock Holmes novel. You can do it. It's allowed.
All your fanfics are true.
Pretty much. And that's a really good example, because a lot of people don't realize that, because there are very famous Sherlock Holmes adaptations.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people think like, oh, they got the rights from the Conan Doyle estate or something like that. And there is, they actually, the Doyle estate does have an interest in the works that come out, but they don't get paid for them, because that is public domain works.
Right.
And so you go ahead and make your Sherlock Holmes game.
Yeah.
Like, why not? Cool. You know, reinvent Sherlock Holmes any way you like.
Yeah.
And of course Disney did it with the Great Mouse Detective, and a lot of their films are adaptations of public domain works.
Yeah.
Ironically.
Yeah, they are. That's Disney.
Yeah.
I'm humming at you.
Yep. Yep.
there's this show that I used to watch when I was a kid called Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd Century.
Yes!
Oh, you my know god, yes!
Oh, Sherlock Holmes in the 22nd century.
Oh my goodness, yes.
Careful, that song is under copyright.
Dang it.
Hey, we did under 30 seconds.
See, that's a very common notion of what fair use means.
Oh.
We can talk about that in a future episode.
Okay.
But no, you're actually fine for other reasons than it was less than 30 seconds.
Phew!
free advertising.
Yeah.
Right.
Watson is a robot. It's great.
Yeah, it's kind of wonderful.
Yeah, but like that's the kind of works, the creative the work that you can do when something's in the public domain.
Yeah.
And it's not just about like kickstarting your innovation because like, I mean, as an artist, I could kind of just rather come up with my own thing.
Sure.
But there's something about taking something that people know and give it another twist, give it a spin.
Yeah.
Because then you can leverage people's familiarity. You can confound their expectations. You can make comments on what those things were in the time they were contemporaneous,
yeah.
but also adapting them to your own time and maybe like confronting those differences. It's a type of creativity that is just not as common because it's not as accessible
yeah.
as it maybe used to be. And the things even now that we're able to do with that are so far removed from our culture mm-hmm. that it becomes harder to find those connections other than sort of superficially.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. I think there's a parallel between that and games in that like you'll take an old game, like an old platformer, Mario, for
yeah.
example, and like you can build your own platformer that is like a twist on Mario's genre. Like mm-hmm. plenty of games have done the thing where like, you know, Mario can jump on Goombas. In this game, if Mario jumps on Goomba, you see the whole story of like that Goomba's family or something and what it means when that Goomba dies and all that stuff. They've yeah. done that kind of things. Like you can do that for past works and experiences in that way.
And a lot of the reasons you can do that in video games mm-hmm. is because those mechanics are not protected.
Right.
Right. And the derivative works you do are protected by fair use for different reasons, right? Because they're sort of parody or because they're commenting on.
Yeah.
But the like Nintendo, in fact, patents are software patents are a very hotly debated issue, right? Like Nintendo could have tried to get a patent on jumping on an enemy to kill it.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's something they could have done. But the enforceability of that is, you know, up
well,
in the air.
Well, that's like, what is it? The thing where you play games during a load screen? Like, isn't that
yeah. mini games in a loading screen, right? Or you couldn't until recently, I think.
Yeah, I think that was thrown out.
Yeah.
But that did change some people's behaviors and yeah, it could come up with other solutions to those sorts of things. Now, of course, that seems like a tragedy, but also think about Donut County.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
Donut County was straight up ripped off by one of those like high volume mobile developers,
right?
And they made a ton of money.
Yeah,
Threes was ripped off by 2048, or the yeah. other way around. I honestly don't remember.
I think it was Threes. Yeah, was ripped off.
And those companies they exploit the creative works of others,
yeah.
and then they have maybe a better marketing sense, and then they leverage and they exploit that
yeah.
for the maximum gain, which then takes market away from that. Now. In light of those, who's to say we shouldn't have software patents, right? Mm-hmm. But at the same time, software patents have been very damaging in other cases. They prevent innovation in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
There's a very famous, and I'll put this in the show notes as well, but the Oracle versus Google trial over Android and the Java runtime, it's this epic notion of where Oracle, which bought Sun Microsystems, didn't even create Java themselves,
mm-hmm.
But they had the rights to the Java runtime, and they accused Google of using a lot of their private APIs when they were developing the Davlic runtime for Android, which used a lot of the similar thing. The Java's a language is open source, but the runtime was closed source, and so there's this complete crazy thing. And the truth is Google kind of did it. Like,
yeah.
they kind of did.
Mm-hmm.
But like, the law kind of came down on their side. Like, even if they did, it didn't cause real damage, and those software patents were unenforceable.
Right.
Now, that's one side where it sort of seems like, well, Oracle was just out to stop a competitor and prevent innovation in the industry.
Yeah.
But sometimes it's the case where those patents could protect people from actually having their work stolen.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to, like, that's why case law is really important in these things. And so you can have like established sort of standards and flexibilities and stuff like that.
Right.
But it's a really hard question to answer. As a creative person, you have to say like, oh, as a creative consumer, like I want access to whatever. I don't want things like DRM. Yeah. I don't want to have creators being penalized. I don't want them to have to license the thing they're using, which costs me more money when I want to buy it from them.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you don't want those things, right?
Yeah.
You don't want people limited in their creativity to create derivative works or create extra things.
Yeah.
And then as a creator, you're like, I don't want people to create derivative works of my characters because then that will dilute the impact of my character in the creative
right.
marketplace.
Yeah.
And so there's no one answer.
I think that right? it's important to like ask the question. I think that a lot of with this law, a lot of it was like delaying the question, and now mm-hmm. we're finally getting to the point where we can start asking the questions again.
Yeah.
And I think that's good. So we just got to start asking that question a lot more frequently.
My thing is that a lot of times the law helps the big companies, but doesn't help the little creators who don't have enough money to, like, I was follow a lot of artists on Twitter, and a lot of times their pin, like they make artist pins or whatever, and their pin designs get stolen by big companies that then put them on. And it's like, obviously the same thing, just like, oh, they moved a line here, so it's totally different. But not. And like, they have hard, like, it takes them so much effort to go after those claims, where like a big company can just be like, hey, company, shut down all these posts or whatever, shut down all these things. And like, it's, they have enough resources to do that. And so,
like, those are cases of clear copyright infringement. Like, there's no wiggle room there, like software patent stuff. Like, this, they stole it. Like, what are you gonna do?
But it's, but it, but sometimes the artist just has to let it go, because like, they would be take way too much of their time and effort to, it would cost them more money to get their money back than it would to
100% of the time. It would cost them like too much money.
Yeah.
Like, that is, it is. Yeah. We don't, you can't call the cops on someone. Right. You have to sue. Right. This is, these are civil matters. In fact, and that's the question, is like, should the, a lot, what is, what rises to criminal copyright infringement? Right. The reason that the, you see the FBI warning in front of all those Burnham movies is actually just a scare tactic by the MPAA, right? It's technically true, right? But it's like, it, it's an effort to give the force of government to a lot of these things, which are civil matters.
Sure.
And, you know, like, they're not like scams, but they're definitely presented in a way to give you an impression of things that are, so like, the leverage those companies have is so much greater than any individual artist.
You know? Yeah, wow.
So it's like a bummer, guys.
Well,
but you know, it's an, it's important to consider, and that's why that's why I'm sort of using this public domain as an entry point into this idea. To think about when you create your own creative things, like what freedoms are granted to you to take the inspirations from the world, and not just because they exist or because artists post things on Twitter that inspire you, but because of the legal protections that people have to be able to distribute and share, and the legal protections you have to create derivative works of a certain type. And what are you prevented from doing, and how does that hurt you as an artist? But then also, as an artist yourself, how can you be protected, and how can you also let go and allow your works to be created? Like, it's cultural and ethical, almost more than legal in a lot of these ways. And the legal frameworks we do attempt to define it, and they really are an expression of what we believe as a culture in a lot of ways. And so when people have very ideological, like, this is the way it should be, it's always like, well, there's always somebody on the other side of that. And the question is, a lot of times, like Martha, you're saying, like, all these small, like, maybe there should be, like, the DCMA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, it allows people to issue takedown requests. And actually, it allows anyone to issue takedown requests. It's actually fairly liberal in who has access to it. But the people who do it are like, you know, 20th Century Fox.
Right.
Like, those are the people who do it. And then you, on YouTube, you get one strike with no arbitration if Fox says you violated their thing.
Yeah.
Like, famously, someone posted a clip of a video game to YouTube, and then Fox took that clip and put it in an episode of Family Guy. And then the original clip got taken down because it was a content match with their automated systems. And so, but who owned the copyright to that? Because the person who posted it didn't make that game.
Yeah.
They just posted that clip. And so what is their protection as a creative artist for creating a screenshot or a video clip of a game that is their performance in the game? Like, the law isn't able to handle a lot of these things. And then the automated systems we have tend to really favor the people who have the enforcement to do it. The DCMA is something I could really go on about how terrible it really is and how it doesn't give people the benefit of the doubt in a lot of cases. But no, think about that. I think when you create your own works, and like, I mean, I'm making Metro Nexus, which is a spiritual successor to a game that is less than 95 years old. And I can do that because there are no protections on the mechanics that I'm using.
Right.
And so that's something that's definitely benefited me.
Yeah.
But I also mean, at the same time, you have to wonder, like, well, I stay away from actual protected artwork. And I do that not just as a way to avoid getting into trouble, but also to keep me working on my own things.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay. Yeah.
And so it can be inspiring to be limited in some ways.
True.
So lots of stuff, guys.
Yeah. That's awesome. I really enjoyed that talk.
Oh, one piece of trivia.
Yes.
In Metro Nexus, there's going to be a song in the final level that is actually from that video game. And I can do that because that song is in the public domain.
Hey!
Which they did because they didn't have any money to hire a composer.
Right.
So.
That's cool.
Yeah. It's really, really wonky, but it's super interesting. And if you, you know, if you like these wonky topics, you'll, and it can really inspire you.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. That's awesome. That's our show. If you haven't already, subscribe to Nice Games Club in your favorite podcast app and be sure to give it a good review if you liked it or are nice like us. We really do need to know you're out there, so leave a review and tell all your friends too. We also want to hear directly from you, so follow us on Twitter and all the other things at Nice Games Club and email us at contact@nicegames.club. Lastly, you can find out more about the show and your nice hosts, as well as get all of the links and show notes from this and other episodes at nicegames.club.
So until we start again, remember to
play nice
and make nice.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.